This morning we're going to have a look at contemplating the thought stream, using thought itself as a meditation object. So far in the retreat we've been emphasising the relationship to the body, because that's fundamental in this practice. And it's the foundation, and you could say that the basic practice, first in the sense that that's what we work with first. We spend a lot of time with that in the earliest part of the retreat, but also that it remains always the foundation. It remains the home base. So to have awareness connected with the body is really important throughout the whole process. So it's something that we always work with. But body itself is not enough. We cultivate a refined awareness of the body, but that clearly is not enough. And the evidence for that is can be seen in our own culture. We do have a tradition of the careful cultivation of body awareness, which we as a society admire and support and put lots of public money into maintaining. We call it sport. And we admire people who have developed extraordinary levels of body awareness in particular forms of activity. So in rugby league commentators, for example, we praise a player who can step off from both the left and the right foot. Well, I'm not quite sure why that's significant, but apparently it is. And doubtlessly they spend many years training to do this. But we admire people who can display great awareness of body. We admire them when they're on the paddock or doing the performance. But often when they get off the paddock, they're complete idiots. and people are constantly being surprised at, oh my God, he's not such a good role model for the kiddies. Of course, the surprise is, why would you expect him to be? Because awareness of body doesn't translate necessarily into anything else. We can still be ethically profoundly stupid while physically very intelligent. We need to shift. In terms of Satipatthana, this is shifting from the first foundation, which is body, to the others, feeling, which we've experimented with yesterday, and the third one, which is the most important one, citta, mind or heart. So one's inner being. Now this third foundation is quite vast. We're going to talk more about it. But the area that I want to begin with is that aspect of the mind which is the thinking mind, which is in some ways the from moment to moment the most obvious part of the mind, and certainly that part of the mind which can create the most problems for the meditator. Has anybody in their meditation ever been disturbed by thinking? Has this ever happened? You may find it difficult to believe, but it is a very common experience. We could say it's a major barrier to people developing samadhi, unifying the mind. So getting to grips with it is very important. The problem, well, first of all, thinking itself is not a problem. Thinking is one of the things that the mind does. It's not the only thing the mind does, and it's probably one of the least important things it does. But it is simply one of the things that the mind does. There's nothing wrong with it. In fact, it's necessary. And when the Buddha talks about wisdom, panya, he includes thinking. D.T. Suzuki, who popularized images of Zen in Western culture, gave the impression in his writings that wisdom is something which has nothing to do with thought. And in fact, the abolition of thought is a precursor to the arising of wisdom. This is pretty much complete nonsense as far as the Buddha is concerned. Thinking is always a very important component of wisdom. The problem is not thinking. The problem is addiction. Most of us are addicts to our thinking. I heard that when the first Westerners started going to Southeast Asia to undertake serious meditation, which would have been early 60s, that generation of meditation teachers, of course, welcomed them. This is fantastic. People are coming from, you know, the world that everybody here wants to reproduce, and they're coming to our little village temple to learn how to meditate. And it didn't take long before the teachers were absolutely horrified by these people. Their minds would never shut up. They just were so laboriously slow in making any progress whatsoever in the meditation. When you look at that generation of teachers, most of them came out of peasant backgrounds. They came out of an environment in which there was no mass media, virtually none by our standards, in which life was very simple and very physical, and they didn't think very much. Which doesn't mean that they weren't intelligent, it just meant that they didn't waste their time doing a lot of thinking. And this would be typical in traditional societies. But in our society, we have constant, relentless bombardment of the senses through the media in all of its forms, and we're trained from a very early age to think, and we're told that think is really, really good, and that when we go to school, what we learn to do is to learn how to think. And so it's not surprising that by the time we reach adolescence, we're totally addicted. The problem is the addiction, not the thinking. So the contemplation of the thought stream is essentially looking at our relationship to thought, as well as the way the mind creates a reality. The other aspect that makes thinking so seductive is, as we were talking about in terms of the five aggregates last night, when we create a view of self, and self again, we're coming from a first-person discourse. If there's a self, if I think I'm real, then I am in a context of a world. I can't have me without a world in which I function, of which I am part. So if you think back to your earliest memory, the first time you can remember being aware of the fact that you existed as a separate entity. At that moment, was there a world? And of course there was. You can't have a self without a world. And you can't have an experienced world without a self to experience it. They always go together. So to construct a self is to construct a world. This is the world that I live in. This is what it means to me. And it all goes together. So what thinking does is construct that world for us, moment by moment by moment by moment. Thinking creates a reality, and it creates a reality which is centered upon myself. So the mind throws up, the mind is like this fire constantly throwing up sparks. And each spark is a cognition, a knowing. And these are constantly being thrown up because the mind is incredibly creative and energetic. That's what it does. The awareness will rocket in and pick one of these little sparks, grab hold of it, and turn it into a movie. We turn up usually after the movie's already begun, and find ourselves in there with a ready-made self and a ready-made world. And this is my reality. This is what is real to me. People throw around this expression, the real world, which I find very, very bizarre. Particularly because if if you go to a lot of retreats, as I do, then you constantly find this kind of rhetoric. Ah, yes, it's all very well here, but what about the real world? Mm-hmm. And I'm always reminded by this. Many years ago, I was in Bodh Gaya attending a retreat run by Christopher Titmuss. And he was giving some talk or other, and there's responses from the floor. And there was a German fellow towards the back who said, "Yes, but what about when we get back to the real world? What about then, eh?" And Christopher looked at him with complete puzzlement, and he said, "You think Germany is real?" And he may well have been having a go at Germany, but I think we could probably say the same of any other country. "You think this is real?" reality is something we create, and thinking is one of the major ways in which we create it. We create narratives of ourselves in our world, and we believe these narratives. These narratives are the reality for us. Even when the world keeps bumping into us and negating the narratives, we just keep the same narratives going. Sometimes reluctantly we modify them to a certain extent, but basically we keep investing reality into the narratives. So I'm sitting here in this situation, the mind throws up a narrative of the past, and whammo, that's my so-called real world. That's what I believe in. And I believe that I, sitting here now, am that same person that I imagine in this imagined past. We live in fantasy most of the time. It's quite bizarre. So the power of thinking comes from our determination to identify with the narratives, with the fantasies, in order to create a self. And that's why even the most boring, trivial and repetitious thought pattern is so fascinating, and why we can't let it go. And why we really, 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 really have to finish this thought off before we do anything further. So we get right into this relationship when we use thinking as meditation object. The basic activity that we engage in with this practice is objectifying the thought stream. What we're doing in the meditation project is studying our own subjectivity. And we're studying our subjectivity in a very systematic and objective way. We're training ourselves to be completely objective about our own subjectivity. "Oh, that's interesting. I'm so outraged that I could strangle you. Isn't that interesting? What does it feel like? Where does it come from? Is it in the body? Is it in the mind? What does it feel like in the mind? What does it feel like in the body? What's the relationship between the two of them?" And so on and so forth. It's a completely bizarre way of being. But this is the project. We objectively study our own subjectivity. So we objectify our subjectivity. We keep, you notice the language we use, we talk about the meditation object. So what's the object? How does the object arise? How does it cease? What does it do? Even the language we use to talk about meditation is training ourselves to objectify our own subjectivity, which means we have to step back out of it and look at it as if from a distance. So this is particularly important when contemplating the thought stream. Again and again, what happens is we get sucked into it. Our normal default position, our habit, is to be inside the narrative. What we have to train ourselves to do is to step outside the narrative, to look at it from the outside. And this is constantly repeated, this activity, because we constantly get sucked in. So the activity, the work of the contemplation of the thought stream is this stepping back out in order to look at it in an objective way. The image that I always give, because that's so nice, is provided by Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj, who talked about this practice, comparing it to a mother watching a child play with a favourite toy. So the child is absorbed in the toy, like we are absorbed in thought. The mother sees the toy, but that's not where her interest and her focus lies. What she's watching is not the toy, but the game. And it's different. She's watching the child play with the toy. And this is what we do in contemplating the thought stream. We step away from the toy. We don't reject it. We don't suppress it. We don't try to get rid of it. But we watch the game, how the child is playing with the toy. Often in the practice, we're told about primary object, secondary object. Staying with the primary object, our attention gets pulled away by the secondary object, or pulled away by something. We turn that something into the secondary object. We note the distraction, and then we come back. And despite the simplicity and the clarity of this, people persist in misunderstanding it, so that when we find ourselves pulled away by thought, we think what we're supposed to do is note it like a hammer hitting on the head so that it will go away. Thinking, thinking, thinking. Get out of here. Back to the primary object. And the disastrous thing is that for a certain proportion of meditators, this works. You can actually keep thought at bay. You can actually suppress it for a period of time and cling ferociously to the primary object. Not everybody can do this, but some people succeed, which is terrible. Because what's the result? You just suppress thinking. But it's there, seething, and it's ready to come up at a moment's notice. And all of what's in there, all of the disordered mind and heart that it represents or that it reveals, is untouched. So to note it is to really get to know it. And we can't get to know it if we're busy pushing it away. Nor can we get to know it if we hold on to it, because then we're just lost inside. So again, it's the middle way. Not suppressing, not indulging, but staying, holding that middle position. So as a rough rule of thumb, in this practice, we're not interested in the content of our thinking. That's normally where we go. We're very vitally concerned with the content of thought. Here we're concerned much more with the process of thought, the play of thought, the way thought moves, and our relationship to thought. That's what we're interested in. As a rough rule of thumb, I often tell people, and I do it myself, when you're in a retreat, treat every thought as a lie. Just assume that it's a lie. Don't give it any more credence than that. The content can indicate something useful. Also, you can, for example, differentiate different types of thinking by content. Content can tell you what your latest obsession is, for example. It's not that content is completely useless. It's that our tendency is to get lost in it all the time. So don't be so interested in content, but on the process, the flow of it, the play of it, and the relationship to it, which will be working on in a few little exercises. We're going to do some experiments in using thought stream as meditation object. In all of them, we begin with the body. So start with resting awareness in the body, And then at a certain time, you'll be asked to direct awareness to the thought stream. So use the body as your anchor. If you get lost in the thought stream, pull back to the body, re-establish yourself, and then return. Any questions so far? Okay. If you get into your posture. Constructing the posture from the ground up. And settling awareness into the body. And settling into your normal meditation object. And at this point, stop thinking. Don't think. Any success? No.
I almost panicked when you said some stuff.
You couldn't stop.
It's very difficult.
Why not? What stopped you? What prevented you?
Just that line. But then I thought, calm down. Just go back to the object, so that was a little better.
And when you went back to the object, did you stop thinking?
It seemed better. I don't know if it was stopped 100%. Probably not.
But it certainly did improve.
Yeah.
So the statement, stop thinking, had the effect of generating massive amounts of thought. But when you could just, okay, forget about it, and settle into the meditation object, the thinking didn't stop, but it dropped down.
Decreased, yeah.
So what we find is that when we absorb into something, for example, something physical, thinking will decline. If our attention is absorbed on something physical, there's less room for thinking. But it doesn't stop. Yeah, Christine.
I have that experience, but also thinking isn't just thoughts, is it? Because when I wasn't thinking thoughts, and we heard that vehicle go up the road, I didn't think vehicle going up the road, car, noise or anything. I just had a little mental vision of a vehicle, or if I hear a sound, I don't think bird, but I see a little bird in my mind.
So what, again, like with feeling, I've made absolutely no attempt to define what thinking is, what we mean by thinking. Except I've talked about narratives, which is strongly implying stories and words. But that raises the question, which you have answered, is thinking just story, or is there something else as well? Once we start to look at the mind, the mind's generation of a reality has layers. And what we normally call thinking is just at the surface. Underneath that, there's other things happening. I sometimes... It's like those sparks that come up. I gave the image of the sparks. To me, they're often... like I call them cognitions. It's like mind units of knowing, which will arise, but then I'm not satisfied with that and I'll close it with something. So I might suddenly know that it's time for a cup of coffee, and then I will explain carefully to myself that it's time for another cup of coffee. Now, this explanation is completely unnecessary because I already know, but I have to put it into words. So you can have a cognition that you know there's a car on that road, but then it's necessary to clothe it with something extra, like an image of it. So this activity of the mind to add something, to embellish what it in fact already knows, is one of the things that I think becomes clear. Anyone else? Anyone succeed in stopping? This is the real thing. Yeah? You stopped?
I just had ever-increasing circles.
Of no thought. No thought. So you're able to stop until the bell rang.
And then I went away from the circles completely, and I was just in nothing. Like I said to you yesterday, I got into nothing.
Anyone else succeed in stopping?
I can't say that it stopped. Like you said before, right? There's a slowing down. But for me, kind of a screen comes down. And there's nothing going on. That I'm aware of. Which is thinking.
Is it? Is awareness thinking?
Look, what is it? What is awareness if it's not thinking?
Good, very good question.
So, I'm aware that I'm not thinking.
So there's a knowing.
So I must be thinking. That's how I feel.
Yeah. So there's a knowing that there's no thought.
There's no progress being made. There's a numbness, to be thinking, there must be some kind of, for me, this is my idea, to thinking, there must be like a start and a finish, it must be going somewhere. You can't be just saying, rain, forever. You know, basically, it sounds like rain. It is rain. Now it's stopped.
Yeah.
So, like, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
There's a start and a finish to the thought.
Yeah, there's, which is some kind of story. Storyline that has a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Mm. So basically that's what thought is, isn't it?
So it has to have some kind of meaning.
Yeah, yeah.
And meaning comes in a story.
Mm.
Of some sort.
But there is a slowing.
Mm.
Basically. You know.
Yeah,
but definitely, when you say stop thinking now, you can think, oh, well, that's my objective, to slow thinking about slowing this thought down, and it does seem to work.
Mm.
So there definitely is a slowing.
Okay, good.
But ceasing,
some people find that with the instruction that they can, with a great effort of will, can hold the thought at bay, but they have this sense of, it's like there's this clear space and there's a wall, but behind the wall there's a building pressure.
Mm.
And it's just a question of time before the dam breaks.
Because that holding is a thinking, isn't it?
Well, whatever. Depends what we mean by thinking.
I found that if I held my breath, I was holding my breath to keep to stop the thinking. I started to find just that there was this tension here, and that was how I was in control and not thinking.
Yeah. So you create a tension in body and mind, and that can hold off the thought.
Mm.
So presumably not a long term strategy.
It work as a long term strategy.
Hmm?
It work as a long term strategy.
Well, as long as until the body gives up. That's funny.
The mantra of the book. You could replace the thought, the random thoughts, with the mantra.
Hmm. But isn't that replacing one thought with another thought? But for practical purposes, I do find mantra is very useful. If I've got a lot of, my mind's very noisy when I want to meditate, I think mantra is a very effective way to cut through it, because it's thought substitution. But it's a less agitating kind of thought, and then you can settle it down. Yeah.
What is single-pointed concentration, or the meditation where you take your mind to a point and you focus on that for however long, is that cutting off thoughts, that particular type of meditation?
That opens up a huge area, because one of my recent hobby horses is I don't believe in single points. And I think this notion of single point of concentration is a load of codswallop. But it's, if basically the way samadhi works is that if you're absorbed in something, you forget to think. So thinking drops away, because the mind is so absorbed in its object that it doesn't even occur to it to think. So thinking just drops.
Somehow you have to become really totally
yeah.
in love with that object.
Yeah. The example that I like to give is going to see a good movie. Which, when I go to the movies, for me is always fraught emotionally. Particularly if I go with anyone else. Because apart from the trauma of actually working out which movie we're going to see... I have very good taste in movies. I don't like people with crude taste. I've learned after decades that it basically, if you want a good movie, you just got three. You need three ingredients. You need blokes from East Asia wearing armour and biffing each other. If you've got these three ingredients, you're probably in for a good movie. But other people disagree with me. So you've got to work your way through that first.
So you're a John Wayne fan.
Please. Did he ever wear armour? I don't think so.
Yeah. You knew you got hit.
Then you turn up at the theatre, and I hate missing the beginning. Absolutely loathe it.
Mm-hmm.
But other people don't seem to care. So there's a whole area of fraught social relationships.
Is that because you spent so long deciding on which movie to go to?
That's one of the things. And then there's working the way through the teeny boppers who were guarding the gates and trying to sell you all this sugar. And then there's finding the right seat. And then there's negotiating, because after you, especially when you're short, you know, you sit down in the seat and some tall idiot comes in and sits down right in front of you. And then there's the other idiots who are behind you who are nice, having a nice chat, and are they ever going to shut up? And so when the movie begins, the mind is very agitated. But if it's a good movie, you start to, you're not trying, but you just start to get sucked in and start to forget. You forget about the previous traumas. You forget about the people you're with. You forget about the person in front. You just forget as you get drawn in. And that is samadhi. So samadhi is a process of being absorbed into something and just forgetting other things are shed. Just forget them.
Do you stay for the closing credits?
Not these days.
Why not?
Except now I might have to change because one of my favourite Korean movies started with the closing credits, and then the credits actually stopped and it went in to another scene of the movie which filled in the final piece of the puzzle about the whole previous movie, which is very sneaky. And then they resume the credits. So let's have another exercise in which we examine the question, how do you know that you're thinking? So if you get into your meditation posture, settling into the body and into your normal meditation object. Then turn your awareness to the thought stream. Are you thinking? And if you are thinking, how do you know that you're thinking? Because if you know you are thinking, then thoughts must be appearing to you in some way. How do thoughts appear? Do they appear as words? Do they appear as visual images? Do they appear as feelings? Do they appear as something else altogether? Do they appear as combinations of different things? Study the flow of your thoughts, not focusing on their content, but on their appearance, how they present themselves to you. How do thoughts appear? Okay. So how do they appear? In other words, what are they?
For a long time nothing happened.
Because
I wanted to think,
So thought has the characteristic of the police that when you want one, there's never anyone around. It is. Yes.
I think may as well. Same thing.
Yep.
And I was thinking, the thought I had was, this is such a relief not to be thinking.
And how did that appear? How did you know you're thinking that?
It's a voice. It's talking.
So words.
Yeah, words. Talking to myself.
Yep.
That's my thought.
Anyone else? Words? Anything else?
I just thought that when I went away from the trivial conversation I was having with someone, and I left that and went into sound, the face came up asking me to. The person I've been talking to appeared without a thought. And then I had a sort of amused reaction, and then I softened into the sound again.
So visual image.
Visual image. And
words.
Dialogue.
Yep. So, and so there are two voices, were there? Not just one.
No. I've been saying something to this person.
Uh-huh.
And I finished off the conversation and changed to sound. And then the person was sort of.
Yeah, so when you had the conversation, though, there are two different, two voices. There was you talking and the person talking.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So what, not just monologue.
She wanted to finish the conversation. That was great.
Sometimes the words are just monologue, but sometimes there's more than one player in there. Sometimes people have this sense that there's a whole number of people in there and they're all chatting away, either to each other or to the person. Anyone else?
I just found it quite unsettling that, unless I picked a topic and started a discussion with myself, it was really completely uncontrollable. That the subject matter would just lit here so quick I could hardly even catch it.
Mm-hmm.
Random. That what was going on was quite chaotic.
Mm-hmm. Was it? And was it voices?
Barely any voices. I mean, there'd be a thought, like a written word, I'd say.
Uh-huh.
A silent kind of.
So you could see words.
Sometimes I can.
Hmm.
But it's just more like so fast; it doesn't actually embody in anything.
Okay, so if it's really quick and restless, it doesn't have time to really register as a clear appearance.
It could be an image, and it could be a sound. And I notice sometimes that my eyes are tight, as if I'm reading.
So there's definitely a visual element in there,
yeah.
But it sounds like the main thing. The predominant thing is the energy of it.
Yeah.
That there's the mind's restlessness, that you can feel the mind zapping from one thing to another, to another, to another. But not. But because it doesn't stay in any one place long enough, you don't get a firm appearance of what that is because it's
right.
Already gone somewhere else.
Unless I latch onto one and create the scenario,
then
I can. Then you can.
If you can impose control, or by bringing it into a good old yarn,
right,
is a form of actually controlling it,
yes.
of slowing it down to a certain extent.
Right.
Yeah. One of the things that does become clear about the thought, about the mind, is its energy. It's incredibly energetic and incredibly fast. And what we're doing, of course, is we're looking at different aspects of the thought stream, zeroing in on what's there, what its nature is, to give us opportunities for meditation objects. What will I focus on? One thing which I find very useful for focusing on is is energy, is that precisely that restlessness, which is air element. I experience it as air element. And it does have, there's a physicality to it too, the tension in the body, mm-hmm. which is very, very close to it. When I tune into thinking as energy, at that moment it isn't thinking. It's mind activity, but it's not thinking.
Right.
And even as mind activity, it's also body activity. And sometimes it's really hard, you can't really make the distinction whether it's body or mind. It's just activity. It's air element. Mm-hmm. That's all. And at that point, I'm not thinking. I'm experiencing the energy of the mind.
It's kind of like static electricity in the air.
Mm.
Like, without any meaning. Yeah. You just like...
Yeah, there's no meaning.
Right.
Zip. So... If you learn to target the energetic quality of it, it's an excellent meditation object.
Sounds challenging.
Mm. It's easy to be thrown off because it's so energetic and so quick. But it's also apparent. It's there, as you've just described. Yeah.
Can it manifest? It manifests as just like this, kind of like a vibrational thing, or is that no longer air then?
Oh no, that's air element too, yeah.
Because I find that can happen,
yeah.
Especially on retreats, and I'm just conscious that I'm just on a really subtle level just doing that, you know, all through the body.
Yeah, through the body, and you might notice it through the mind as well.
I sometimes wonder why we get these constant distractions. You say we hear that go by, or a bird and whistles or whatever, and why do you find that such a distraction? And I think, why do we find that such a distraction? And I thought, what if it's all about security? You know, and then I go right back to being an amoeba or a single cellular, go right back to the beginning. Okay, so you've got a little amoeba. All it wants to do is be itself, but it's floating around in its environment constantly. You know, is this water or the fluid medium that it's in, is it too hot, is it too cold, is it too alkaline, is it too acidic? So constantly having to be aware of its environment. And these messages are all the time coming back into, even at a unicellular level, are coming back into that little being. And even though all it wants to do is just be itself, it's got all these external stimuli saying, yes, this is okay, no, that's not okay, I've got to adapt to this and be aware of that. And we live in such a complex society now, we like to think we've come a long way from being amoebas, I guess, but at the end of the day, we're still responding in very, very similar ways.
Mm. Yeah, it's just this is natural process.
Yeah, and we haven't lost that. Right?
No, it's we're just tuning into what's really going on.
Mm.
That's all.
Yeah. Problem is now we've got a brain.
That does make things more complicated. Let's do another one because we're being a bit slow today. This time the question will be: where do you think? So again, settling into the body, experiencing the whole body, and settling into your meditation object. And turn your awareness to the thought stream, and in particular to the place where you think. This is the same as locating the point where physical sensations arise. The difference is that physical sensations always do have a precise physical location, while the thought stream may not. We generally experience our thoughts in the area of the head, so you might start there, but don't take anything for granted. Don't assume that you know, but look. Where do you think? Does thought have a location? Does it have more than one location? Does it have no location whatsoever? Where do you think? Any luck? Did you pin it down? Where's that?
It's all around.
So outside of the body?
From the back, when something's happening out there, it comes in from a thought starting it. My mind is intangible.
I'm sorry, but I'm not quite clear at all about location.
I wouldn't say it's a location.
So
I'm just inside of thought.
Yeah, but we're asking about location. Where do you think? Did you find a location?
Not specifically.
Okay. Any general idea about location? Because you keep the way you're waving your hands around.
It's in my head.
It's inside the head.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that I have to think using my brain.
Well, maybe, but. So you found it inside the head?
Yeah, the thoughts are above. The screen is there.
Okay, so inside the head, but you can't precisely locate where. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. It's like intangible, like it just is like a river and I'm in it.
Inside the head? Yeah? Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Yep.
Sometimes it seemed to be in the heart and in the throat.
Mm-hmm.
And then I sort of played a little game with it, I suppose, when I was concentrating on the heart or the throat, it seemed to skip up to the head.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. But, yeah, so really, it varied.
Mm-hmm.
Often mainly around the heart-throat region, that's mm-hmm. the main...
So heart, throat and head. mostly heart and throat.
More in the head for me, I'm afraid.
Head.
Mostly behind the eyes. Seem to be behind. More the head behind the eyes.
Okay. In the head behind the eyes. Lynn, did you?
Yeah, in my sinuses.
Ah.
Right? Behind the eyes and a little below.
Mm.
Extremely precise.
Mm. Sinuses.
I've been watching for some time.
So it's pretty consistent. Same location.
Yeah. Although I can relate to what Christine says about sometimes when you're actively talking in your thoughts, it engages the throat a little bit.
Mm. Yep.
I've done this exercise with you a couple of times now, and every time I've done it, it's changed,
mm-hmm.
which in itself I think is pretty interesting. But today it was all frontal lobe, it was all between the temples, just bouncing back and forth.
Yeah. One of the things about these exercises, meditation in general, but especially these exercises, is that you do get very different experiences. It's not one thing. People can get reasonably consistent patterns, but it's never the same. And sometimes it's wildly dissimilar from one moment to the next. Yeah. Diane?
Like different thoughts happening at the same time. Some of them were sort of towards the front, but then there's this voice that kind of helps me along, like with the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a little helper, and that's like at the back.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, that's why, you know, people say you've got this sort of little person on your shoulder or whatever. Mm-hmm. It really did, it does feel like that. Mm-hmm. There's somebody sort of behind me helping me or something.
So there's thinking in the front, and then there's the commentator or controller or mentor or guide further back.
Yeah.
So you've got at least two locations. Mm-hmm. Are these? Did you feel that these both were inside the head, or could it have been outside the head?
Yeah, the little helper one definitely seems just to be around this area.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Is it coming from any power of suggestion?
Oh, quite possibly. The mind is very suggestible.
Yeah, I realise it. It is only suggestion.
Oh, well, is it? That's the question.
Or is it that? I'm sorry. I'm not saying it as a state.
Yeah. That's one of the things we need to look at. This kind of this whole enterprise of insight meditation has got many more questions than answers.
Okay. Because I found with the thought, the exercise beforehand, the thought seems to me a bit like bubbles coming from somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Being small, depending on my concentration, being small at first, and it related to what you said about the air. And then they came through, and I was aware enough not to go there and watch them and see them move.
Mm.
Rather than. But if I was to pick the thought, or catch the bubble, and start investigating, then I had a moving it. But if you were to watch it just float past.
Mm. And do the bubbles have a location?
No, it was just like on a screen.
Mm.
But they do seem to come from somewhere.
Okay, so there's some hint of location, but you can't pinpoint it.
You say they come from under a rock or something.
Yeah.
The bottom of the pool.
Yeah.
And what's that rock look like?
You're self-conscious.
I have to find that rock, concrete it down.
And concrete the hole up where it's coming from. It's not coming from the rock, it must be coming from under the rock.
Yeah.
So there's a little cavity there.
Yeah.
No, I think of it really, this is there's so much of our mind that we can't access. And it, I think of it as the surface of a lake. And basically random thoughts kind of pop up, and we notice them or we don't.
Mm.
But we have no control over what comes up out of this lake. Mm. We don't know what's in there.
A bit like light, too. Going up and turning to a star and bursting.
Mm. Mm. With the... with
if you allow.
With location, people sometimes can find locations. Sometimes they're definitely inside something. Sometimes they're inside the head. Sometimes they're in different parts of the body. Heart, for instance. Throat. Heart's fairly common. Sometimes people can have a very specific location, but it's outside the body. It's just there. Or whatever. Sometimes people can't pinpoint any location. And sometimes there's a definite sense that this does not have location. That location does not apply at all. The variety of possibilities are endless. The point of the exercise, of course, is not where you think. The point of the exercise is learning to train attention to the thought stream without getting caught up in it.
Mm.
So you can be creative with these exercises. Another one might be the Vedana of the thought stream. What does it feel like to be thinking? I find that's a good one. If you're really sharp, or if you want to be really sharp, then do the cat outside the mouse hole exercise. Catch the moment it begins, the moment thought arises. So you're like the cat watching the hole, waiting for that little thought to pop out, and as soon as it does, you're going to get it.
Mm.
That's a really interesting one. So catching the arising. Another one is like beginnings, middles and ends. Can you catch the beginning and the end? Or maybe because it's so quick, you might try it the other way around. Are there gaps in between thoughts? And if there are, can you find those? If you find yourself can't let thought go, lost in it, hopeless. So there's a deep attraction to this. Can you make the attraction the meditation object? The fascinating quality of the thought, the determination to think. Could that be a meditation object? So these are all exercises in aim, in learning to direct awareness to a different aspect of the mind in order to give it something to hook onto, something of the process, the activity of the mind to hook onto, and then to start to open up what's going on, instead of being at the receiving end of the completed fantasy and being swept along by it. Thought is very good as a secondary object if you are bothered by thought, if you are distracted by thought. That's when you would use it. If you're not particularly bothered by it, you don't have to worry about it. The thought stream, sometimes, you don't have to spend very long on it. Mind is very quick, and you can see it in a very see clearly what's going on in a very brief period of time. So you might only be there for a second or two, and then come back. But in that second or two, not with the hammer hitting it over the head, but with the scalpel going in there and having a look at what's really going on, and come back. Or you might spend longer there. You might. If the thinking is dominant, you might spend a fair bit of time using thought as meditation object. A few people actually use it for primary object, but very few. It's not really, for most people, it's not really suitable. If you spend too long on thought stream as a meditation object, it can become very heady. It's very powerful. It's a lot of air element in the upper part of the body, and it can really spin you out. So If that's happening, you need to get back, get away from it, and earth yourself. Walking can be good for that, or any kind of physical activity. So the thought stream does have its own characteristics as a meditation object. Very fast, very powerful, energetic, creative. The relationship to the thought stream is central. It tends to be one of addiction. We tend to be addicted to it. But opening up the mind as meditation object is extremely useful. Any questions or comments before we finish? Yeah, don't.
Okay.
Oh,
no. Sorry.
Christine.
Talking with others away from here and just discussing this, often it's just taken as granted that the only thing that thinks is the brain,
mm-hmm.
and you sort of feel a little foolish when you're trying to explain that the brain and the mind aren't necessarily the same thing.
Mm.
Well, probably it's better not to discuss it with them, I suppose, but is there any way, these people are Buddhists. Is there any...
Buddhists?
Yes. But they're still firmly convinced the brain does the thinking.
Cripes. Well, if they're Buddhists, I mean, it's perfectly obvious mind is not the brain, and the brain is not the mind. So it's a bit of a puzzle why... Certainly in the materialist scientific orthodoxy, there's this obsession with the brain.
Mm. Which is people that work for the health department.
Which is quite bizarre obsession. Mm. But I would have thought if you're a Buddhist, you must be bleeding obvious that mind and brain are two different things. Mm. But I always come back to pointing out that the Buddha's teaching is a first person discourse. So if you say it's the brain, what's your experience of the brain? Well, I don't have any experience of the brain. I experience the mind. I don't experience the brain. The brain is a concept. It's an inference. I infer it must be the brain, but that's an inference. It's not a direct experience. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Sorry, did you say that the thoughts are the primary...
They can be for some, a few people. Anything can be a primary object. For a few people, it can be, but it's not recommended. So, no. It is a good secondary object.
Okay. So, focusing on like the body or whatever you... Primary is yeah. embodied.
But when
and then
the thinking pulls you away,
yeah.
when it grabs you,
okay, yeah.
then study it.
Mm-hmm.
Don't chase after it.
Okay.
But when it grabs you and you note the thinking mind,
yeah.
then the idea of the exercises is to give you some ideas about how to go about doing that.
Yeah, great. Mm. Okay.
But only when it grabs you.
Okay.
Don't go looking for it. Maggie.
Ideas can be a terrible hindrance because they become quite profound when you're on retreat. If you like, you've got a wonderful idea for some creative assignment. And off you go.
Yeah.
I do it regularly. Yeah. It's been on this retreat, didn't it? So far.
I remember once doing walking meditation in Panditarama in Rangoon, walking up and down the hall writing this magnificent novel. And I just had to stop. And it was so sad. I thought the world of literature is never going to be the same.
Is that because it's a gobbledygook? It just feels good inside
the retreat. Oh, the mind gets very clear and very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
That's it's the tempting thing. As samadhi develops, it's not that distraction disappears. You get a much better quality of distraction.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes people can have the experience, it's like the mind is even noisier than it was when they, before they started to meditate. It's much, the distractions can be much more vivid, much more interesting, more real, and but also it can be much more profound. And generally, as a rough rule, if you think less, if the quantity of thought goes down, the quality will go up. So one of the advantages of stepping outside of the thinking addiction is that intuition improves. So the thoughts that do pop up are generally much, much better. Much better quality.
I sort of see thinking as a representation of consciousness,
mm-hmm.
in a way. It's like just a stream.
Mm.
What is the connection between consciousness and thought thinking? Are they separate things? Or
yeah, it's awareness itself, or consciousness, is vijnana, which is a knowing of, awareness of something. So if there's awareness, there's an object. So the object could be visual, I can see you, or it could be mental, I know I'm thinking. So the thinking is a mental activity. It's a mind, it's a mental state. In the Abhidhamma, you get the terms citta, cittasika. And in this instance, citta is awareness, cittasika is the contents of the mind. So it's like the citta is the inner space within which mental activity takes place. And the things that pop up are the cittasikas. The Buddha uses other terms. He uses the term manyana, conceiving or conception, as they're not quite thoughts, but they're conceptual constructs that start to create a self and a world. But I can be, the mind is always throwing these up, and I may or may not be aware of them. So I can be going about my daily business. My awareness is of what I'm doing. And the mind is creating a world, creating a meaning. This is what's going on, and I'm not even aware of it. I might become aware of it only when it's brought to my attention, when I stop and reflect on something, or if somebody challenges my perception or whatever. So there can be mental activity that we're not aware of. So in the Western tradition, we talk about the unconscious, the subconscious, the conscious. We assume that there's layers. We assume that the mind is busily doing stuff, but we have no idea that it's doing, no awareness that it's doing it. And you get the same thing with the Buddha. We are not necessarily aware of mental activity. So it's like when you suddenly realise, I am already angry. So there was a whole lot of mental activity going on, of stewing away, a complete absence of awareness. The first thing I know about it is when I suddenly say, "Oh, get out of here!" Whoops, where did that come from?
This is what Freud would tap into.
Yeah, that's what Freud definitely tapped into. Yeah.
Right. Interesting connection. I just sort of wondered in terms of.
So what we're doing, in a sense, is widening the field of awareness and bringing awareness deeper into the process, exposing more of the process to awareness. And one of the things that does is it rearranges everything. The mind heals, which is another thing that Freud figured out, that the mind will spontaneously heal when awareness goes deeper into these subterranean caverns.
Wow, which is what we're trying to do. Thank you.
Okay, are we done? Thank you.